So I think we're ready to start today's session. I have with me here Melissa Friedland, who's the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Coordinator, and she has some introductory remarks that she's going to give to kick off this session. So with that, here's Melissa.
Thanks, Michelle. Welcome, everybody, to the quarterly Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar. As we get started today, I'd like to share a little bit about why we're presenting this webinar and what you all can expect to get out of it. We started these webinars last year in an effort to reach a wide audience on a variety of timely Superfund redevelopment topics and share reuse case studies from across the country. Our aim was and continues to be to provide in-depth site-specific perspectives on key aspects of Superfund redevelopment. So over the last year and a half, we've introduced Superfund redevelopment topics ranging from reuse planning with communities to our partnership efforts to working with local governments. So today, I'm particularly excited about our presentation because this is the first opportunity we've had to discuss a new process we've developed to take an initial look at assessing a Superfund site's potential to support renewable energy reuse. This new process, called a renewable energy pre-feasibility analysis, often involves economic analysis and GIS mapping components and serves as a first step to determine if a Superfund property can support renewable energy projects. We developed the analysis process because key stakeholders at several sites were interested in determining if alternative energy production was a viable reuse. And so today's presentation will highlight two sites, the Iron King Mine Humboldt Smelter site and the Apache Powder Company site in Arizona. Andrea Benner, the RPM at Apache will begin, and Monica O'Sullivan, the RPM at Iron King, will follow. At both of these sites, SRI has provided site stakeholders with pre-feasibility analyses. Our presenters will share the steps involved in conducting the pre-feasibility analysis at their site, paying particular attention to how stakeholder concerns were addressed, outcomes of the analyses, and important lessons learned. So thank you both very much for presenting, and thank you all for joining us today. I believe we're starting with Andrea. Go ahead, please. Hello,
this is Andrea Benner, and good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are calling in this morning. Or this afternoon, I wanted to give an overview of the Apache Powder Superfund site, and if you move to slide 4, that will give you an overview of what I'd like to discuss today. I want to talk a little bit about the history of the site itself, the context of the site, and then look at the renewable energy evaluation process that we went through at this site, and then look at what's happening now as a result of what we did, and then some lessons learned. Moving to slide 5, I should point out right in the beginning that this is a unique Superfund site. Today, in today's world, if it were listed on the National Priorities List, it would have been probably considered a RCRA corrective action site. But at the time of the Record of Decision, it was an operating facility, and it fell in, because it was in the early 80s, it fell into the Superfund listing process and was listed. The site itself is about 1,100 acres. It's in the arid southwest. It is in an ideal setting for solar renewable energy generation. It's located, you can see in the corner of the map, it's southeast of Tucson, and it's in a generally unpopulated area. The site is quite well known in the Southwest. It's the primary explosives manufacturing facility for explosives, ammonium nitrate, for the mining industry, for the U.S. Southwest market and northern Mexico. And they've been manufacturing since the 20s. There's a photograph at the bottom. You can see the old powder line, the old historical setting for the facility. It it has this, if you move to slide 7, you can see the facility from a distant shot in the foreground. This is an area that will come up later. This is an area that's now being looked at for siting solar. It was an area that had evaporation ponds that have subsequently been filled in and capped, and now are a large, reasonably flat area for siting renewable energy. If you move to slide 8, this site has a nice renewable energy kind of history to it, regardless of whether it moves forward with solar or not. From the time I've been the project manager on the site since the mid-90s, and I've held on to this site because it has been so interesting. We put in a constructed wetland system. If you look at slide 8 in the upper right corner, that's a series of constructed wetlands, treatment ponds for treating the nitrate-contaminated groundwater from the discharge of nitric acid and other nitrate, basically the nitrogen from their manufacturing process ended up contaminating the groundwater. So that was already a cutting-edge remedy at the time that record of decision was signed. And along with it, they, in the bottom photo, you can see solar panels that were used to circulate the water. And there's no electricity. This is basically a pretty remote area of this 1,100-acre facility and no power out to this location. So we used, beginning in over 8-10 years ago, started using solar panels to circulate the water between the treatment ponds. Also did some innovative things using windmills to pump and extract groundwater from other parts of the facility for treatment. If moving on, I'm going to now talk about the alternative energy process, slide 9, and then moving on to slide 10, the overview of what I'll walk through. And the approach we used and was to, one, evaluate the energy resource, then look at the suitability of the site, then what technologies might be applicable, and then market incentives and what the financial picture will look like for the site. So those four steps were probably the main steps we went through with Apache to kind of kick the project off as a catalyst. We were very fortunate in the Superfund program to have an intern at that time with us in the Superfund program who had a background in the financial marketing sector, and she recognized from her background, her name's Sarvi Madhavi, and she's still in our regional office, now in another office, but she came up with this idea, and then we put Apache into this memorandum, and we used this as an outreach tool for working with the company so that the environmental manager that I was working with could in turn brief the CEO and in turn brief the board of directors on what the renewable energy potential could be at Apache. And we found, although we could verbalize it, and they already were using solar all at the facility wherever we could, to go the next step, to actually use the facility not for its primary purpose, which is manufacturing still fertilizers and nitrogen-based products, but to move to looking at future use or other uses of that large acreage. We needed some tools, some sales perspectives, in a way, if I put it in those terms. So Sarvi came up with this idea. She did a lot of the research. The memorandum looks at everything from an overview of relevant state and federal standards. It gave a recap of the site history. If you move to slide 12, it also had some detailed charts, some coming off the web of an overview of U.S. renewable energy standards, what local utility incentives are, tax credits, because the bottom line basically for this company, Apache Nitrogen Products, Inc., the potentially responsible party and the owner of this particular Superfund site, the bottom line was, would it be cost effective? I mean, would it make sense for them to do this, to go, to push beyond their normal, manufacturing objectives? And this ended up being, using this kind of approach was also a way to get the foot in the door with the upper level decision makers within the company. I'm going to move next to slide 13 to give you an overview of the energy context for Apache. Their big picture, they spend about over a million dollars a year, $1.2 million plus, on their electrical bill a year just for producing, to run their manufacturing operations. There's some statistics here that you can look at. They are tied into a cooperative. Instead of going right to a major utility in Arizona, they actually buy their electricity through Sulphur Springs Valley Electric Cooperative, so they become a key player. And as you're planning any project, the very first meetings we had, once Apache appeared to be interested themselves, then we immediately had the next meeting with the local utility, because I can't overemphasize how important it is right from the beginning. If you think you want a project at a site, you want to be working directly with the people that are going to control whether it can happen or not. The good news for Apache is they had an existing substation right on their property, and there were plans to upgrade that substation. They already had been discussing possibly building a 3-megawatt cogeneration. They were already talking about other ways to upgrade their electricity, reduce their costs, and looking at other alternative electricity alternatives with Sulphur Springs. So talking about renewable wasn't completely, it was way beyond where they were at the time, but they certainly were open. Moving next to next slide 14. There were two things we were looking at when we were looking at the what might be viable for Apache. And I know that for most folks that are Superfund RPMs, this might seem strange a little bit to you, because most people think of using renewable energy primarily for what can be done to supplement electrical demand for the remedy itself. And we had already, throughout the history of this site, been constantly using alternative energy wherever we could. A lot of the reason for that was just because of the isolation of the area and the lack of electrical lines to areas where we had to, say, implement a groundwater extraction well, or where we needed flow meters. We didn't have an electrical source, so we were already looking for alternative energy wherever we could, or renewable energy. But here, when we were looking at what the scenarios might be for the site, we were looking at, could they use this for on-site use for running their actual operation? So this is sort of looking at future use for a Superfund site. Or would they be just selling it back to the grid? And in Arizona, a lot of energy that's produced is sold on the renewable portfolio, sold back to states like California that have high need for renewable energy to meet renewable portfolio standards. So we were looking at this and analyzing it from the perspective of both possibilities. If you move to slide 15, I'm now going to walk through how we looked at the site itself and what the site itself showed us when the contractor, and in this case this is E Squared Inc. out of Charlottesville, Virginia, who is one of the contractors that EPA has been using for these assessments. And one of the factors, this, if you look at the map on slide 16, you'll see the outline of the facility as being not a square. It's made up of parcels that make a sort of a geometric grid shape, and the operations area is sort of the brownish area down in the bottom lower southern end. And what we were looking at is where we had areas that were less than 5% slope, and in the end, almost always I've seen now as I look at projects, people really want 1 to 2% slope areas or optimally flat. But we did our initial cut and screen of looking for areas that had greater than 15 acres to offer and less than 5% slope. The road proximity wasn't really an issue. This site, being an old manufacturing facility, one, it's off a reasonably major highway that sort of scoops around on the eastern, runs east-northeast, that goes up to Benson and then to a major interstate. It also has a rail line coming in and out of the facility. And it's, as I mentioned earlier, it's rather a remote location, so there isn't an issue of not in my backyard. There isn't, it's such an isolated facility, and because of security, because of what they manufacture, it's quite secure in terms of worrying about trespassing or any issues like that. But we went through this process, identified large flat areas, and then if you move to slide 17, you can see how we divided it up. And at that time, we were primarily looking at either concentrating solar power, trough style, and I'll walk through some of these technologies in a moment, or photovoltaic PV potential. And you can see how we divided it up, color-coded it. And all of this went into a report that eventually was given, presented in PowerPoint format and is now being put into a written report for, actually, at this point, not necessarily for Apache's use, but for use by other RPMs and EPA. If you move on to slide 18, I'm going to now walk through some of the technology, the two technologies really that we looked at. We basically were looking at comparing initially concentrating solar power versus photovoltaic. And we narrowed it down, ultimately it narrowed down to PV photovoltaic, but this is how we kind of started looking at it. Water use with concentrating solar power, which is a basically a parabolic trough, dish Stirling type of technology, there's huge water demands to cool the system, and that in the arid Southwest ended up making CST basically sort of fall off. But we also were looking at how much acreage was needed, storage capacity, et cetera. And there's a series of analyses that E squared went through to sort of help narrow down what would be the most appropriate technology for the site. If you go to the next slide, this is sort of an overview of just what the CSP concentrating solar power. I'm now on slide 20. What that technology looks like and requires, and then the next slide, slide 21 shows you sort of an array of how a photovoltaic system would be set up. And now I'm going to move on to slide 22 just to show you, again, another way of looking at this and comparing what's needed. When you get into photovoltaic, there are several different subcategories of photovoltaic. There's thin film or fixed film, fixed axis. Most recently, some of you maybe have heard that at landfills in Texas, they've been using thin film now just to literally coat the entire landfill with what used to, if you imagine a landfill cover, they now have embedded PV in a in a flexible film, but thicker than a film, that actually a landfill can be covered with. So there's everything from that type of application, which we really, really weren't considering here, to fixed access crystalline silicone or PV tracking. The PV tracking is, you can see that in the lower left-hand corner, a photograph, and the fixed on the right. You also can see the cost comparison of these, and we've also looked at acreage again. The acreage PV tracking ends up needing more acreage because you need room for that panel to be able to move around. But in terms of how we, the costs are, there's some difference, but it's not the same type of difference that one would see between looking at concentrated solar versus PV. If you move on to slide 23, that's showing you one of the ways we looked at Apache's electrical demand for their manufacturing process. It was another way of assessing what might be most suitable. Should they go for a 5-megawatt array? Should they go 3-megawatt? Was more in the range of their peak demand per day. A 3-megawatt facility would work for them, but we were also thinking maybe they could use part of the electricity for their own use and then sell the excess back to the grid. So we were giving them ways to look at choices. Slide 24 gives you an overview of how we try to narratively sum this up for them a bit, that they could reduce their electrical demand if they had solar to offset it. The one advantage of concentrating solar power, CST, and why we looked at it extensively and didn't absolutely screen it out right away because of the water use or the water requirements for CSP, was that Apache generates on-site steam to manufacture their ammonium nitrate. They need steam. They use natural gas right now to produce that steam, and we were looking at could we use CSP to help them with their manufacturing to generate steam. So that was one of the big pluses for that. Looking at, you know, at the limitations, the pluses and minuses kind of can go across both sides of this analysis, but they manufacture 24/7, so that was a big issue of having intermittent solar production, to have their manufacturing be totally dependent upon that. So they would always also need other backup forms of energy. So I'm not going to go through each one of these points, but you can kind of get an overview of how we started to help them wrap up what we had come up with. The last phase of the analysis was looking at dollars and cents, and that actually, with every project now, and I've been involved with at least 4 or 5 different renewable energy projects in Arizona, and then on tribal lands in the last year or two, working with wherever we in Region 9 feel we have potential. And dollars and cents, the actual financial part of it, becomes the strongest part of the decision-making process. One thing that is really important to emphasize, and I maybe didn't emphasize it enough when I talked about that memorandum in the, when I first started the presentation, I mentioned that initial kind of public relations memo. I don't know really how to put, what words to put on that, but it's somewhat of a fact sheet, but basically it was trying to lay out the positives of the financing and financial part of it. And the federal incentives, the state incentives, and the local incentives play a huge part in this equation. And I'll talk about what it meant for moving forward with one aspect of what Apache is actually constructing right now as we speak in a few minutes. But these are very important things to assess, analyze, know explicitly what incentives are offered in your state in that particular location with that particular utility for your project, and try to get a good handle on that right from the beginning. One other thing that that is important to look at, and this is sort of reemphasizing that same point, one would be surprised if you look at this chart on page 27, or look at slide 27, New Jersey, which people very rarely think of as having much solar potential. Actually, if you look at their how much capacity was installed in New Jersey in the last, in 2008, 2009, I mean, it's in terms of megawatts, it's quite surprising. That's even beating out California. And if you look at other states, Massachusetts isn't on this chart, but I think many of you are aware there's a very forward-thinking solar project in Massachusetts that, and I think Massachusetts has been quite forward-thinking with looking at renewable energy. So just because you're in the Northeast or because you're up in North Dakota, you shouldn't think you might not have renewable energy potential. In this case, I'm emphasizing the solar, but obviously, you know, there's wind, geothermal, other technologies that you can look at. Moving forward and next steps, I'm going to just give you where we are now with everything. Looking at slide 29, here's some pictures of some of the things that have been out at Apache so far. The upper right corner shows you a flow meter at the wetlands that where we're using solar to run the flow meter. They use motion detectors. They have solar running their security gates, lighting, et cetera. You can see the panel in the second slide on the right. And then we were using a windmill in the bottom right photo where you see a solar panel now, and you see some what look like circular tubs. Those are evaporation. We're evaporating off and drying out, basically dewatering a perched system of subsurface groundwater that's sitting on top of a clay unit, and we're trying to dewater that area where contamination had previously migrated from the evaporation ponds that I mentioned. And so we're using solar now is actually more effective than the windmill. The windmill we were having problems with, but we've tried everything, I have to say. If you look at slide 30, where Apache is now, the picture on the left is a picture of their primary administrative buildings, office space for the facility. And it's sort of typical Southwest, not very attractive architecture. But they have a contractor came in, and if you can see the sort of awning canopy in the after picture of the solar panels that extend beyond the footprint of the building, in the lower right side on slide 30. They right now are in the middle of constructing this canopy system to offset all their electrical costs for running and keeping this building heated in the winter and cooled in the summer. And even though it's Arizona, in this part of south east Arizona, it is it's a little slightly higher elevation in Tucson, and they actually our wetland ponds have actually frozen once or twice, and they have actually had snow here, very rarely, but it can get cold. So this is going to be a great asset for the company. Slide 31, I'll go back and show you the cost and cents figure. It's a slide or two later, but I'll talk about the dollar and cents about this canopy. But the other thing, besides looking now at their office structure and what can be done to offset their electrical costs there, we have been, and they have been now, taking everything we provided them. They've been in conversation with multiple developers. They actually made contact with their first developer at the Repower America stakeholder meeting that was held in Los Angeles in January, and the CEO and their environmental manager came to that stakeholder session in Los Angeles and sat on the panel, And from that, they made connections at the meeting, and they're looking at these long-term, these high-concentration PV solar technology. This is a photo, a two-axis tracking system. It would be most likely a 5-megawatt facility. You can see some of the details about the construction specifications and needs. If you move on to slide 32, this is sort of a recap of where they are. They have, actually from the time this slide was prepared, most recently I spoke to Apache yesterday, and they are still pursuing this. The initial developer they talked to, they are not yet a stage to move forward in that, and this is a very interesting dilemma. The Silver Springs Electrical Cooperative, SSVEC, is how they move the power from Apache out to wherever it's to go and off their own facility. And as I went through earlier, because they can't rely on solar for their manufacturing, they need to, and they would want to sell it back on the grid. And right now, they have no one to purchase that power. They have the developer at the price that's needed to make this financially work. I need to put it in those terms. Apache has a long-term power, a 5-year power purchase agreement with their current supplier, SSVEC, for electricity. And I don't know the price, but let's just hypothetically, so you can get sort of a sense of how this works. Say they're paying 8 cents a kilowatt hour for their power on some contract. To come in now with this high concentrating PV, this state-of-the-art type of facility, the cost that they would, that for the developer to recoup their investment would probably be in the range of 15, 16, maybe 17 cents per kilowatt. And as a result, this is becoming a stumbling block right now for finding to make this project move forward. But they have, they're definitely still talking to people, they're in conversation with other utilities, so there's nothing in place at the moment, but they're still, I would put this in a holding pattern. But you can see some of the minuses, you know, in terms of where we are in this bottom one, need to find another utility to enter into a purchase agreement. This is where we are right now, how we can get somebody to buy the power that could be produced at the price that is needed for the developer to break, to feel it's worthwhile for them. So now I'm going to just move forward on lessons learned, and I'm not sure if I accidentally missed a slide, but hopefully I haven't. I might go back I want to go back because I should have emphasized one point. If I go back to slide 30, I thought I had a slide with these figures in it, but I realize I don't have this on a slide, and I want to just emphasize something on this canopy project, and it's something to keep in mind with any Superfund site. In this particular system, they're going to get a 30% federal tax credit now on this awning project. They're getting a 10% state tax credit, which is a maximum of up to $25,000 from the state of Arizona. From their utility, the SSVEC, they're getting a performance-based incentive of 0.20 kilowatt hour. They're getting some about 20 cents up per kilowatt hour, up to 60%. So their payback on this project is 6 years, and they're also going to receive about $1,200 a month from the SSDEC. So they're going to actually have a savings to themselves of $7,000 a year just to heat and cool this series of administrative buildings per year. And the bottom line is that 100% of their capital costs were covered by a combination of these incentives, the performance-based incentive, the tax credits, etc. So this is sort of almost you could do a small mini presentation just on this building and then how they basically were able to get it in place with basically no capital cost to the company. And it has a sort of side story because the company, as you can imagine, an old-time Arizona explosives manufacturing facility, pretty conservative company, when the environmental manager went to talk to the board of directors, there were some people that were sort of, in principle, opposed perhaps to solar energy. They thought it was diluting the focus of the corporate agenda, etc. But then when it was presented that it's at absolutely no cost to them and it's going to save the company $7,000 a year on their electrical bill, there was absolutely no way they didn't get 100% vote on this project when it went in front of the board. So now I'm going to skip back to move forward again to lessons learned and slide 34. You know, just looking at this site, and it is maybe somewhat of a unique site because it does have this mixture of ongoing manufacturing as well as being an old Superfund site. One, it had a lot of acreage. It had all the solar potential. It has a big buffer zone because of the manufacturing, so you don't have, not in my backyard, so you have great opportunities here that you may not see in more densely populated and developed parts of the country, but totally compatible to look at solar energy development for this site. When we looked at the upfront costs of comparing CSP and PV, the costs were higher for concentrating solar power by $10 million, but when you're talking $25 or $35 million as an investment to begin with, $10 million may or may not be such a driver. I mean, it is a driver, but really for this making these decisions, I think the water usage drops CSP off the radar screen for us. In terms of incentives and obtaining long-term power purchase agreements, I can't emphasize how important and critical that is for making a project, at least a utility-scale project, and I need to qualify that, move forward. And in many ways, with so many large-scale military and large manufacturing sites in our region, Region 9, in remote areas, and in the hopes of making the maximum impact on greenhouse gas and climate change, obviously these utility scale projects have great value, but you have to have the power purchase agreement and be very intertwined with your utility to make this type of project happen. I'm moving now to slide 35, public-private partnerships. This is really a unique site where the management at Apache was very forward-thinking all along. The environmental manager has a strong, that particular manager at this facility had been an state of Arizona environmental manager before she ended up in this job, and so we were very fortunate, but establishing a relationship and maintaining that relationship is so important when you're moving outside the box, so to speak, trying to be creative, trying to do something. You need to be try to align yourself as much as possible with the values of whatever owner of the property is and to make something happen. Also, knowing all the permitting and regulatory requirements is important, and in the big picture, these projects are complex, but they can be manageable. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Monica. My contact information is on slide 36 if you would like to email me. And there's, I know that Melissa and Michelle will be getting all of this information up for you to look at later. So with that, I'll turn it over to Monica, and thank you very much.
Monica, this is Melissa. If you can hang on just one second. Andrea, I want to thank you very much for doing that. It was really, really interesting. And I just want to say, give everybody an opportunity if there are any questions right now that they'd like to ask.
So if you put us on mute at the beginning of the call, if you're on the phone line, please, you're welcome to speak up at this time. And you can hit pound six. So if you use the local mute, that will unmute you. Again, that's pound six. So if you have any questions for Andrea, please speak up. And anyone who's streaming the audio online, feel free to hit the question mark icon and submit a question, and I'll read them aloud to Andrea.
Okay. While people decide that, Andrea, let me ask you a question. Are you would you do this project again?
Apache?
Yeah.
You know, Apache is my favorite site. I've been a RPM for years, and I have cycled on and off a fair number of sites, and I have clung to this site as my psychological respite. I don't know how to explain it, but because they've always been open to the wetlands, and we did get a lot of interest and mileage out of the wetlands. We have Audubon Society, we have Sierra Club, everyone bringing students out to look at the wetlands, you know, and that was such a wonderful, innovative remedy. That's terribly, you know, we went from a $3 million wastewater treatment plant to treat the contamination there down to, you know, less than an $850,000 wetland system. I mean, it's maybe cost a little more than that, but it saved them so much money. And the raw estimates for the treatment system and the long-term O&M, you know, the long-term costs were so high. So this has been what I call my refreshing site, to be just very honest.
That's great. Okay. I don't see any questions up on the board, and I haven't heard anybody who's gone. Yeah.
Actually, I have a question. This is Chris Wolf, Hydrogeologic. Andrea, the Apache site, the company itself was paying for the photovoltaic array. The reason I ask is on Fundbleed sites, what is involved? Is it possible for the federal government to be selling to the power company, to the utility company? What are the implications in trying to accomplish that? Because we have some Fundbleed sites that love to do some renewable energy, but A, you can't get the federal, there are no federal tax credits really coming back to the federal government, and B, we have the difficulty of, can the federal government go out and sell this power to the utilities?
Well, in this case, some of those questions weren't an issue because this is a privately owned and operated facility.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a fund lead federally owned property. It's a privately owned PRP. And so all they can take advantage with their developer, with sub-corporations or whatever they choose to set up, LLCs, people are very creative in figuring out how to take tax credits. Even tribal lands where there are some issues whether they can take, they if their utility is creative, they're setting up sub-corporations, LLCs, and then using that entity to take the tax credits, or they're working with a developer and dividing up the turf. Who gets the renewable energy credits? Who sells those? The RECs. Who actually gets the power and sells the power? There's multiple economic opportunities by figuring out, getting good lawyers who are energy lawyers to help figure that part out. There's one Superfund site here, a fund lead site. It's the Davis, California. I don't know if anyone on the line, Bonnie Arthur is the RPM on it, but they are, as a fund lease site, EPA is It's going to be the first treatment plant in the country with solar running the treatment plant. And that's happening in Davis, California, and it's SunLead. In that case, the power is all going to be used to operate the remedy, the treatment plant. It's not being sold. If you go talk to DOD and, you know, Nellis Air Force Base, I don't know if Nellis Air Force Base and their solar array is purely for base operations, but I know that the Department of Navy is putting out RFPs for San Diego right now for large-scale, utility-scale operations on their lands, and I do not know the details of. It's a good question, and maybe what we can do is do some research on that to see if there aren't any where DOD may be selling back to the grid in any way. But is anyone else on the line? Ian Penn from E Squared, I think, is on the call. Are you there, Ian?
Yes, I am.
Do you know the answer of whether, have you heard of any selling back to the grid on federal land?
In the work and the research and the things that we've done, I'm not aware of any, whether it's the funding side of EPA or even other federal agencies who are selling directly to the grid. For most of those projects that we're aware of, whether it's Nellis Air Force Base or Fort Carson or some of these other facilities, most of those projects have tended to be third-party agreements, and basically what the federal government's looking for is they want to purchase either renewable energy credits or they want to actually purchase the electricity from the solar or the wind project as part of their federal energy management program requirements. So federal agencies are required to use a certain amount of renewable energy as part of their portfolio. So they're not necessarily selling because they don't, as you mentioned, they don't get, you know, they don't get accelerated depreciation. They don't get the federal tax credit, which is a big credit that makes a lot of these projects financially viable. So they're simply negotiating a rate with an energy developer. So they'll pay a certain price for that electricity. Then that developer will probably sell the RECs to a utility who needs the RECs as part of a state's renewable portfolio standard. And so you have this somewhat at times complicated relationship between three or more parties. But I'm not personally aware of any federal agencies who would be selling directly on a utility scale. Now, for something that is, you know, used maybe for green remediation, there's nothing that we've seen that would preclude a site. If you have a solar array on a site that you're using to power a pump and treat system and you have excess electricity, there's nothing that we've seen or ever been told or researched that would preclude EPA from participating in a net metering program. So, you know, in California, for example, if a site was a client of Pacific Gas and Electric, they could conceivably participate and adhere to the rules that PG&E has for their systems. They probably would be able to make money because PG&E's rules are set up that way, but you could participate in a feed-in tariff program or a net metering program. So any excess electricity you're not using for on-site purposes, you can then get a credit for through that system. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's...
No, that helps out. Thank you.
Any other questions before we move on to Monica? All right, thanks. Monica, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I'm Monica O'Sullivan. I'm EPA's Remedial Project Manager for the Iron King Humboldt Smelter Superfund site located in Dewey, Humboldt, Arizona, and I will be giving a presentation on the pre-feasibility analysis of renewable energy development that SRI supported at this former mining area. Moving on to slide 38, you can see what we're going to be going over, the purpose, site background, regional context, site reuse goals, the renewable energy assessment that was done, potential future use options, aligning cleanup and reuse, and the lessons learned and next step. Moving on to slide 39, why conduct a reuse assessment at this site? The purpose of this reuse assessment is to clarify reuse goals, understand the site's constraints and opportunities, and identify reuse considerations to inform cleanup activities and local planning efforts. The reuse assessment clarified future use goals, local planning goals, site context, and potential future use scenarios and remedial considerations. Conducting a reuse assessment that engages site owners and other stakeholders in evaluating future use options for a site can help facilitate site stewardship and support the long-term effectiveness of the site's remedy. Next slide. So what is a renewable energy pre-feasibility study? Basically, it's a preliminary assessment of the technical and economic viability of a proposed project, determining the most suitable alternatives for further analysis. When EPA met with site stakeholders in 2009, fostering renewable energy opportunities was identified as one of the reuse goals, and so conducting a renewable energy pre-feasibility study was included as part of the reuse assessment. Moving on to slide 41, I'd like to continue by giving you a little background on the Iron King Superfund site. So next slide, 42. The Iron King Mine Humboldt Smelter Superfund site encompasses areas of contamination from two separate facilities, the Iron King Mine site and, or the Iron King Mine and the Humboldt Smelter. The Iron King Mine was an active mine beginning in 1906 and concluded until about 1969. The Humboldt Smelter operated from the late 1800s until the early 1960s. Waste rock and tailings were deposited in large piles adjacent to the actual mine property boundaries. More recently, the mine tailings from the site have been used to create fertilizer. The smelter is situated 1 mile east of the Iron King mine property. The smelter property is bordered by the town of Humboldt to the west and the north, and the Agua Fria River to the east, and the Chaparral Gulch to the south. The map on the next slide, slide 43, shows the geographic location of the mine and the smelter and the town of Dewey Humboldt. So if you go to slide 43, you can see that. Due to past mining and smelting operations, arsenic, lead, and other metals have contaminated the soil, sediments, surface water, and groundwater at levels above background concentrations. The Iron King mine facility covers 153 acres, the majority of which is covered by waste rock piles and tailings. The tailings pile measures to be approximately 62 acres and also about 4.2 million tons of waste rock. The smelter facility occupies approximately 183 acres and has about 185 cubic yards of tailings, 250,000 cubic yards of smelter ash, and 1.7 million cubic yards of slag. On-site ponds, pits, and lagoons are reportedly used for leaching of minerals from mined ore. And you can see that in the map, kind of by the colored features in the smelter and the mining area. Moving on to slide 45, the next two slides, 45 and 46, provide context of the site's access, infrastructure, zoning, and surrounding land use areas. The site's made up of a variety of owners, and part of the purpose of reuse planning was to see if there was a commonality among their reuse interests. In general, these landowners are interested in returning or maintaining the land in a productive use. A range of opportunities have been identified that could provide employment and economic development opportunities, recreation and industrial heritage resources, as well as renewable energy generation opportunities. The different future land use types mentioned included continued industrial and manufacturing uses, mixed uses to include residential and commercial, mining and smelting, museum or library, open space, recreation trails, and energy generated from solar or wind facilities. It was recognized that these uses might not be suitable site-wide, but certain parcels or areas of the site might be better situated for certain uses. Moving on to slide 46, you can see the site context specifically for the smelter property. Take a look at that. So we're going to be moving on. Slide 47 identifies that we'll be looking over the retail context. If you could also move on to slide 48. The site is surrounded by a mix of land uses, including Bureau of Land Management and Arizona State Land Department lands that are currently providing open space views for the town. However, these lands do not currently allow for public access. BLM lands may be designated for recreational purposes following a master planning and application process. Arizona State Trust lands are held assets for trust beneficiaries and could be sold or leased in the future for development, with proceeds going to designated recipients such as public schools. A majority of Yavapai County is owned and managed by federal and state agencies, and only 25% of the county is held by private landowners. The primary landowners are the U.S. Forest Service, owning 38%, the Arizona State Lands, owning 25%, and the BLM, owning 11%. However, not all of this land is open space and recreational lands that are accessible to the public. And if you look on slide 49, it just gives you a pie chart of how the land is distributed among the different property owners. Next slide, slide 50. This gives you a map characterizing the reuse. In addition, the site represents the majority of the remaining land available for industrial use in the area. In the town of Dewey Humble and nearby incorporated towns such as Prescott Valley and Prescott, there is a limited availability of large parcels zoned for industrial use. In the town of Dewey Humble, most of the land is rural, residential, and the site contains some of the only large parcel zoned for industrial uses. And just for a little bit more background on Dewey Humble, the town was just incorporated recently. The towns of Dewey and Humble were incorporated recently to prevent the encroachment of Prescott Valley and Prescott to take upon their land for development. So it was just recently incorporated in 2006, I believe, to become Dewey Humboldt. Moving on to 51, we're going to identify the site reuse goals at the site. On slide 52, so the future use goals at the site were to encourage future uses that are consistent with the town's general plan. More importantly, to preserve their low density lifestyle, ensure continued industrial uses are contained and regulated by ADEQ, Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, provide educational resource on former mining and smelter activities, foster renewable energy opportunities, provide public recreational access, and ensure individual economic development opportunities. On July 21st and 22nd of 2009, EPA and E2, E squared, met with 1080 stakeholders to gather a set of preliminary goals and considerations. These primary stakeholder interviews included current site owners, elected officials, Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, representatives from the town of Dewey Humble, and interested community members from the town council. And these are the previously stated goals are what came from that meeting. I'm going to focus on the renewable energy pre-feasibility study of this, of what came out of that discussion. So moving on to slide 53, the renewable energy assessment. Now moving on to slide 54, this shows the renewable energy assessment process, the steps that it took, evaluating the renewable energy resource, assessing the site suitability, identifying appropriate renewable energy technology options, and the review of energy markets and incentives in the area. Slide 55 shows a map depicting annual insulation averages in Arizona. To begin, the pre-feasibility study took a broad look at Arizona and its solar insulation annual average. Arizona is expected to have a unique reliance on solar to meet future renewable energy requirements. Projections suggest upwards of 65% of the state's renewable energy demand in 2025 will be met by solar energy projects. On-site PV provides many options at the Iron King Mine Humboldt Smelter site due to its flexible installment options. Most of the U.S. have adequate to good PV resource quality, and Arizona is defined as excellent. Some of the challenges solar installation projects in Arizona face include high upfront costs, low utility rates relative to nearby states, increased water demand for an arid state with abundant source resources, and competition for solar projects and solar manufacturers from neighboring states due to attractive tax incentives, manufacturing incentives in New Mexico and California. Moving on to slide 56, demonstrates the solar energy trends in Arizona. As you can see, the PV systems installations doubled in Arizona from 2007 to 2008, and Arizona is ranked fourth for installed capacity in 2009. Moving on to slide 57, a number of policies and incentives are available to facilitate the development of renewable energy projects at the federal, state, and local level. Renewable energy credits are tradable commodities separate from the electricity produced that bundle the attributes of renewable electricity generation. Because they are unbundled from electricity, renewable energy credits are not subject to transmission constraints. There are two primary REC markets, mandatory and voluntary. RECs generated in Arizona would be subject to voluntary REC prices, which are priced between $15 and $60 per REC. However, if a power purchase agreement for electricity generated on site was signed with a regulated utility, such as the Arizona Public Service, any generated RECs would belong to APS and would not be available to be sold on the voluntary market. Incentives include both policy-based incentives and financial incentives. And some federal incentives include business energy tax credits, clean renewable energy bonds, and rural business enterprise grants. Some state incentives include Arizona Renewable Energy Standards, and solar energy equipment sales tax exemptions. Moving on to slide 58, there are incentives offered by the Arizona Public Service, the local utility in Arizona. In 2008, APS purchased or generated 609,926 megawatts of renewable energy, or 2.1% of total retail sales. This figure exceeded the company's renewable energy standard goals by 0.5% for the year. APS continues to seek proposals for utility-scale PV solar projects to meet a portion of their annual RES implementation requirements. For 2010, APS has issued a request for proposal for new renewable energy project proposals. Projects must be at least 15 megawatts in size, with a maximum of 50 megawatts. Moving on to slide 59, this slide outlines the existing site considerations and related future use goals for the Iron King Mine area and how they may vary for each zone. Zones 1A and 1B include those areas of the Cools Capital LLC properties that are most suitable for development. Zone 1B is delineated to represent portions of the Cools properties that might have access challenges, and Zone 1C represents the most suitable development areas of the North American Industries properties where the mine tailings pile is located. Zone 1D represents the most suitable development areas of those parcels south of the Iron King Mine Road, and you can see that all on the table. Moving on to slide 60, this table outlines the existing site considerations and related future use goals for the Humboldt smelter area and how they may vary for each zone. Zone 1 was delineated into two separate areas based on potential remedial components and future use considerations. Zone 1A includes the portion of the site that is assessed by a primary road and might be best suited for mixed uses that could include commercial or industrial uses due to the close proximity to downtown and existing infrastructure. Sensor uses in this area would blend with surrounding uses to the northwest and could provide an opportunity to tap the ash present in the area. Zone 1B differs from Zone 1A in that it has fewer remedial considerations and has limited access. This zone might be more suitable for less intensive uses such as residential or recreational uses. Moving on to slide 61, we're going to start talking about potential future use scenarios at the site. So on slide 62, you can see these future use scenarios. For the Iron King mine area, several potential future use scenarios have been identified for the two major landowners of the site. Continued manufacturing, light industrial future use scenario. This scenario includes continued manufacturing and light industrial uses on a parcel-by-parcel basis with individual owners. Access and infrastructure improvements would be needed to develop remote parcels located in Zone 1B, as noted on Figure 18 with an asterisk. Another future use scenario is recreational access to surrounding trails and open space. In the town of Dewey Humboldt's master plan, it identifies a potential trail along the Galena Gulch that would cross the southern portion of the area and another trail along the Chaparral Gulch. These potential areas, these potential recreation access points are highlighted. Recreational access might also be suitable future land use component for the future use scenarios in this section. And another scenario with renewable energy. With 300 days of sunlight a year, average solar insolation measured at over 6 kilowatt hours per day, and sitting at an elevation of 4,500 feet, the Iron King area has a very good, is a very good area for solar resources. In addition, transmission access is readily available at the site with three-phase Power 3 already in place. A 69 kilovolt transmission line runs through a portion of the site, and the local topography suggests that portions of the mine are within a 10% grade and could be used to support various solar options. Moving on to the next slide, slide 63, this shows a reuse characterization map of the Iron King proper area, which has the tailings pile and the former operations area. Moving on to slide 64 to talk about the Humboldt Smelter future use scenarios. Several potential future use scenarios for the Humboldt Smelter have been identified. A significant portion of the smelter site could potentially accommodate solar energy projects given topography and aspect. However, because of the potential number of mixed use opportunities by the smelter area, how much of the area is visible to surrounding community and site proximity to Main Street, and potential plans to revitalize Main Street may not be an ideal area for renewable energy. The Humboldt Smelter area could also serve as a good potential location for a biomass energy facility. The area offers relatively flat topography and available acreage, which could support the infrastructure, such as the plant or feedstock storage of a biomass facility. Because of the proximity of the smelter area to Main Street and the viability of the Knob Hill real estate area and the former smelting process area, some additional research would probably be needed to evaluate the compatibility of a biomass facility with other mixed-use opportunities at the smelter area. And then if you see on slide 65, you'll see the reuse characterization map for the Humboldt Smelter part of the site. Moving on to slide 66, aligning cleanup and reuse. Now on slide 67, the Iron King Mine contains several areas of concern, including a former landfill that is being filled, a large tailings area, surface soils with elevated levels of heavy metals. This table describes the potential remedial components and remedial considerations that could inform future uses at Iron King Mine. So the table is pretty self-explanatory. Moving on to slide 68. Areas of concern at the Humboldt Smelter include the slag area along the Agua Fria River, the tailings in and along the Chaparral Gulch, ash piles, tailings piles, debris piles. Potential remedial components for the ash and tailings pile include containing the materials in on-site repositories with protective caps. The sizes and locations of these repositories will greatly inform future use opportunities at the site. A containment cell in this area would bisect the area. The containment cell cap might be suitable for a range of uses, including parking to support new development for an RV facility, lightweight structures, or recreational uses such as soccer fields. A tailings containment cell adjacent to the Chaparral Gulch might be suitable for PV solar as described in the previous section. Depending on the grade, the northern portion of the cell might allow for lightweight uses on top of the cap, such as parking or recreational uses. And consolidating scattered ash and debris in one area might create a large area in Zone 1B that might not require land use restrictions. So moving on to slides 69 and then 70, lessons learned and next steps. A 1 to 2 megawatt solar PV project would be currently possible at the Iron King Mine area if the right financial arrangement between landowners, project developers and APS could be reached. APS periodically issues RFPs for in-state renewable energy projects to help the company meet its RPS goals. APS is currently focusing on 2 to 15 megawatt projects as part of the company's 2010 RFP solicitations, and typically looks for projects with a levelized cost of $150 per megawatt hour of electricity generated. Longer term, given where the site currently sits in the Superfund process, additional information on cleanup requirements and potential site limitations, such as weight limits for potential containment cells, would help clarify the extent to which large-scale PV development, particularly in the smelter area, is feasible. Cleanup activities at the site could also take advantage of the solar resources at the site and potentially incorporate solar technologies as part of the green remediation strategy. And slide 71 has my contact information. Thank you so much for your time, and I would be happy to take any questions at this moment.
Again, I'll just remind everyone, if you want to ask a question, if you're on the phone, feel free to speak up at this time. If you used our conference call mute, you can hit #6 to unmute. And then also, for those that are doing the audio streaming, or anyone, can hit the question mark icon at the top of the seminar and submit a question online that we'll present to the presenters. So at this point in time, does anyone have any questions on the phone?
This is Melissa. I thought of a question, and that is for both of you. What kind of obstacles did you run into at EPA to kind of do this, to do this kind of non-traditional thing? Did you feel that you had the support you needed?
This is Monica. Sorry, you want to go first, Andrea?
No, you go first,
okay.
Monica.
I was just going to say that, in fairness to Leah, I've only been on the project for about a month and a half, and she was a real go-getter, and, you know, when she, I guess, was approached with this, you know, she took advantage of the opportunity to have something like this done and, you know, got the support from her management, and here we are today with a completed reuse assessment. So, yeah, I can't really speak to that part of it just because I've only been on the project for a month and a half.
Yeah, I actually, a better way to ask that question maybe would have been, what is it that we could do to encourage managers to be as supportive as they can about these kinds of projects?
So this is Andrea Benner, and I'll have to tell you, I've always been sort of on the cutting edge of being interested in this approach. I received a Region 9 award for being the greatest risk taker from the RA one time for the wetlands at Apache. So, and I've been in EPA for so long, I feel I've been generally quite supported. And we may be fortunate because we're based in Region 9, we're based in California, we have Arnold Schwarzenegger as our governor constantly promoting the green economy for California. We have a very high renewable portfolio standard, you know, we have very ambitious state goals. So if anything, Region 9 appears to be behind, you know, if we're a national lead, we're nationally behind the state of California. So there's a little bit of awareness at the management level, particularly because our new RA came from the city of San Francisco, and the city of San Francisco is very, very proactive. They have put on their own website, you can go on Google Earth and map your rooftop in San Francisco if you have an industrial or any type of building, and get a they have an interactive website where you can find out, if I put so many solar panels, how many solar panels can I put on my roof and what benefit will I get from them? And they have a whole team of people for property owners in San Francisco to interact with. So we have, you know, a highly motivated regional look at renewable energy. So I would say, what we do need, I think we really could use, is FTE, someone to go to the Hill somehow through that process and get some type of sub-program established somewhere where there's legitimate FTE that could be dedicated to this without stealing from the other existing water air programs, because that's really, you know, a turf issue, I guess. Do you know what I mean? I mean, just in a resource-constrained world, no one wants to steal from your friend or your fellow manager. And the other is having more of these seed grants available in an easy sort of process where you're not always having to compete. Because, in other words, when you have a willing property owner or a willing site manager on the PRP or the private side or wherever, and you have an RPM that's interested and motivated, just make sure you have X quantity of seed packages for doing these evaluations, because the evaluation itself then becomes the vehicle one uses to for those property managers, PRPs, whatever one wants to, you know, or PRP groups if they have committees, to then sell it to their colleagues. And this is really the packaging and promotion of this has, we're doing this kind of independently on our own, with our own creative will. And I don't think anyone in Region 9, stands in the way other than when it comes to travel, and they can't, I've combined all my work with travel to sites that I can bill, basically. In other words, if I'm doing something on renewable energy, I am trying to go do my site visit in the same location. So we're all trying to piggyback through existing resources and not run afoul of misuse of Superfund money, which has to be so carefully managed. So, I don't know if that's exactly if I could sum up, but, you know, having FTE, having some kind of allocation or appropriation, you know, in some way, and you're talking to someone who sat in headquarters getting Superfund tasks, so I remember those days. You know, we had to explain the need and how I mean, maybe it would be going back to DOE and asking DOE to provide us some money, but I don't know if they'd ever, in their resources, in their constrained world, if they'd ever give us resources. But it's sort of sad we don't have a pot of FTE and resources, because I think the Superfund managers are all looking at what they have to do to get so many RIFSs done or so many construction completes, and putting renewable energy isn't a bean. It, you know, maybe even just putting beans on it in some way, to use an internal EPA term.
Right. All right, let me just ask again if anyone out there has a question, and certainly feel free to submit a question. I think we might have run up a little bit against the fact that today is September 30th, and it's the end of the fiscal year, and I know a lot of people are just sort of going a little crazy today, but I do appreciate everyone being on the call, and I do very much appreciate the presentation that you guys have made. So let me just throw it out there one more time. Would anyone like to ask a question? We'd be happy to take your questions.
Yeah, this is Trey Hess with Mississippi DEQ, and I was curious, with so many fund lead sites and the fact that the states have to come up with a 10% cost share, has there been any discussion? And also remember that we have the long-term O&M on those. I was curious, has there been any discussion about allowing the states to use their 10% cost share to do the feasibility as well as any of the infrastructure needs in terms of buying solar for Superfund sites that we're going to have to deal with on the long term?
You know, Trey, I can tell you I haven't heard any of those discussions, but I think that a really good place to bring that up might be with the SWAMO. On one of their subgroups. I don't know if you, Andrea or Monica, you want to weigh in on that?
This is Andrea Benner. You know, this is a really interesting point that we haven't explored or really pursued the conversation, but we should. I have a landfill, Hacienda Landfill. It's in the state of Arizona outside of Phoenix. And the PRP group, initially, they're one of the PRPs, and they were not really interested in renewable energy part of the PRP group. But then the property owner, being the landfill owner, Maricopa County, they realized, oh, my goodness, we could, for our long-term revenue stream, maybe we should be looking at putting renewable energy on this larger, the Superfund components, 10 acres of maybe 50 acres. So maybe we should, on all the other acreage, start looking and plan for a long-term renewable energy facility to provide a revenue stream back to the county and or to offset long-term O&M costs for the remedy operation. So I do think we need to kind of be thinking of future use in terms of helping states or counties or, and they, I don't know, it helps the PRP groups to offset long-term costs. And that speaks a language to the PRPs if they can save money or offset costs, and I'm sure it would speak to states if you have state-owned sites.
Yeah, that's a good point, Trey. Thanks for raising that. Any other questions?
Well, and just one last thing is, Trey, I'm actually on the ASWOMO Long-Term Stewardship Task Force, so it's probably something that we'll talk to Larry Zaragoza and others to maybe look at in the years coming out, because obviously states don't typically have a funding stream that it's more than 1 year at a time, and that's just maybe another way of, if there's some flexibility with using that 10% cost share towards that piece of the puzzle, that might be a good policy on the part of EPA.
Yeah, it certainly bears more discussion. I'll look forward to that. Thank you.
So this is Ian from E-Squared. I mean, Carlos Pashon might be another person where how something like that might fit into the green remediation strategy at the agency as well.
Great, thanks. Anything else? Okay, go ahead.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining in our presentation today, and I especially want to thank the speakers for their very interesting presentations. And also, as Melissa mentioned at the beginning of our session, we are doing these seminars on Superfund redevelopment quarterly, so stay tuned for the next session. We haven't identified a topic yet, but we should be doing one in the next few months, so stay tuned for that. And I also want to direct your attention to the last slide, slide 72, where we provide resources and additional information on this topic. And then we also have a feedback form in which we request that you click on that and provide us with your opinion of today's session and any ideas you might have for future sessions. We do review these and take them very seriously, so if you could take a couple minutes to do that, we would greatly appreciate it. So with that, I want to thank everyone for your participation and attention today. And enjoy the rest of your day, and take care.